come to order.
I love doing that. Got a big crowd today. Anyway, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2021. And Teresa, you want to explain what's going on?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2021 establishes that if a public agency fails to include state and federal prevailing wage rates in a public works contract or fails to include information showing which prevailing wage rate is higher for workers in each trade or occupation in each locality, the agency is liable for workers' unpaid minimum wages, including fringe benefits, and in an additional amount equal to the unpaid wages as liquidated damages. This measure has been approved by MLAC, and in front of you, committee members, there is a letter of concern from the Oregon University System. Lisa Zavala was unable to attend the hearing due to a prior engagement, so, but you have the letter in front of you.
Well, we'd like to call Mr. Sean Miller, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sean Miller, and I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. And before you today is a bill, House Bill 2021, which we wholeheartedly support. And it comes from a bill that was introduced last session and passed last session, Senate Bill 477. And this aims to correct what we thought was the intent of Senate Bill 477 of last session. And I believe going around, I actually have the bill from last session, and I want to reference it as we go through this discussion, because the bill from last session was the major prevailing wage bill of last session, where we consolidated several different issues into one bill and passed it. That particular bill of last session was started, and most of the discussion was in the House Business Committee, where the chairman, Representative Schaffler, participated in a work group, as well as Representative Holvey, who was actually the initial sponsor of the bill, and Representative Hanna, who also participated. And in Representative Holvey's bill, the original intent of the bill was to create a policy of in prevailing wage, where you look at each craft. And currently we have a state prevailing wage and we have a federal prevailing wage. And in this new policy that was passed last session within this bill, you would look at the higher of the two wages and apply that higher wage to that particular trade. And when that bill did pass, what it created from the standpoint of the Bureau of Labor and Industries was there was now two books to where you would have to look. You would have a state prevailing wage book that Boley has been producing since 1995, when the annual surveys were created, and they're probably the biggest major reform in prevailing wage of the last decade. And this would actually say if there's federal money that goes to a project. So again, it's just not state money. For instance, if you know the difference between building the Department of Agriculture building with just state funds versus a local government that might have some federal money connected to it. If the federal money is connected to the project, you would actually look at this other book, which is the state or federal, whichever is higher, and apply that rate for those particular trades. And one of the concerns that was brought up in the work group led by the chair and Representative Holvey was that from a contractor's point of view, if there's two books and you're told by an agency, you know, which book you need to follow, there's no way for the contractor to know or understand the funding sources, because the owner of the project's the only one that's going to understand the funding sources. And therefore, from a liability standpoint, if you were told as a contractor to use a particular book, and again, this wasn't a problem before because it was one book, one prevailing wage, and you were told to use the other book, you can see how there would be confusion on the contractor's perspective from a liability standpoint. And so if all this particular bill does is say if you publish the wrong book, whether it's the state or federal, whichever is higher, the liability is held with the public agency, the owner. And what that does is, again, there's no way for a contractor to ever know if there's a piece of federal money involved in a project. And this bill particularly ensures that the not only contractors performing the work, you know, are properly informed of the funding sources so they themselves can understand and make sure that their employees are being paid the proper wage. But again, it protects the, ensures that the workers are being paid the proper wage and the intent of Senate Bill 477. And so this issue wasn't uncovered because we thought it was agreed upon last session in the work group that this, the responsibility would lie upon the agency, obviously. And the bill, and this is a 477, on section 10 of the bill, sub B actually describes that responsibility, and it simply says the agency shall include the publication that shows the prevailing rate of wages of state or federal, whichever is higher, is produced by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And so, you know, shall provide this information to the contractors so they know the proper wage. When we went through the rulemaking with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, we wanted that clarified, obviously, the liability. The contractor would not be solely responsible for back wages if they were given the wrong information. The Prevailing Wage Advisory Council, which I am a member of, as well as Bob Shiprack and members of the labor. It's like the Management Labor Advisory Committee on the workers' comp side. It's an advisory committee that looks at all prevailing wage issues, and that it's appointed by the Commissioner Dan Gardner. Looked at this issue and supported the change. However, the Department of Justice thought that it conflicted with the existing joint and several liability statute. And so the intent of the bill only deals with the circumstances where they're state and federal and they're not given the correct information. I want to be clear because we did not want to affect the state, the joint and several liability standards that apply to all the, you know, the existing projects today. And so that's not the intent of the bill. It only addresses the narrow issue. If you are told the wrong book essentially to use, you're automatically going to be paying your contractors or your workers the wrong rate according to Senate Bill 477. And so, that's pretty much the issue in a nutshell. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer. But again, we believe it was the intent of 477 to encompass this within the bill, but did not, or found out later that wasn't the case. Last week, the Prevailing Wage Advisory Council met and voted unanimously to support the bill. And so, with that, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, so in the case of, if there is no state prevailing wage rate, like in the case of residential affordable housing, then how would this obligation affect public agencies?
We believe it wouldn't affect them because I believe under that circumstance on the affordable housing side, and I know this is something that Phil Donovan is very interested in, and that is if they receive their federal money, they're under a federal Davis-Bacon and are going under that particular rate, this would apply on liability if there's a project that a state agency may have. And, you know, like the example of the, let's say the Department of Agriculture is building a building, they might receive some kind of funds from the federal government, and they list it as the state book and not the state and federal book. And so we're distinguishing that the liability in that narrow circumstance would be upon the agency if they give us the incorrect information. And so I guess to answer your question, I don't think it applies, but we can further ask that question. I think it's a good question maybe for legislative counsel, and I think I could probably explore that with Phil. I think asked me the same question.
Okay, Mr. Miller, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just on a final, I noticed some amendments to the bill, and I just received the concerns from the university system, and I'm not positive, but I think they believe that we're trying to change the liability on the entire statute and not the narrow applicability of state and federal, but I'm not sure. So I want to clarify that, because as I read that letter, I was confused, and I thought that they were confused of the intent. And so I just want to get that on the record. And I understand that there is some amendments as well from the city of Salem, and there are issues that we have been interested in the past. However, I think they are issues that you'll just have to contemplate as a committee. But we have been interested in those issues as well in the past. So I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you. And we don't have any amendment language yet. But speaking of the city of Salem, we might as well have Mr. Schweinhart and Mr. Randall Tosh come right on up right now.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Schweinhart with the City of Salem. With me today is the City Attorney, Randall Tosh. We have some issues with the bill. Generally, we support it, but the issues we have, we think, are serious, and I'm going to let our City Attorney address those for you.
Before you get going, we don't have any LC drafted.
No, you
forgive
me,
but I think I have seen this or something like it already, just to clarify that.
Okay. There are a couple of issues that the city would like to raise with the committee today.
Sir, you need to introduce yourself for the record. Identify yourself.
I'm Randall Tosh. I'm the city attorney for the city of Salem.
Thank you.
The first thing I'd like to discuss is the issue about liability. We believe that there is an existing problem with the statute, and the statute appears to create strict liability for a contractor in a prevailing wage situation, even if that contractor has not received notice that there's a requirement to pay prevailing wage on a particular project. So let's say that the public agency has failed to give notice, and the contractor has entered into some sort of agreement with the city that BOLI subsequently determines is a contract for a public work. Even though that contractor may not have had notice that it's a prevailing wage project, BOLI takes the position that they owe the prevailing wages. We think this is a problem with the statute that ought to be addressed, and we've submitted some language that would clarify this and would act as a pendant to the proposed amendment and would only require the payment of prevailing wage if the contractor had notice of the requirement. And if you look at the existing language, we think that this actually does change the language of the current statute and does appear to modify the strict liability that you find in subsection 1 of the statute. The second thing that we would like the committee to consider are changes to 279C 850 sub 4, 279C 870 sub 1, and 652 331B. Under current law, if BOLI brings an enforcement action under these sections of the ORS and the public agency or contractor loses the case, the public agency or contractor must pay BOLI's attorney's fees. However, if BOLI loses, BOLI does not have to pay the public agency's or the contractor's attorney's fees. It's a one-sided attorney's fee situation. We would submit that this is fundamentally unfair, as it punishes the public agency or the contractor by imposing a substantial financial burden on them, even though they've demonstrated that the state agency did not act according to law. Making attorney's fees provisions reciprocal furthers the legislative purpose of the statute, as it makes the agency responsible for its interpretations and helps to ensure that those interpretations reflect the legislature's purpose and intent in enacting the law in the first place. I don't know if you're aware of the current way that BOLI handles prevailing wage determinations. If a public agency has a question whether a specific project is subject to prevailing wage under Oregon law, the local government can ask BOLI. And under our administrative law, BOLI could issue what's known as a declaratory ruling. A declaratory ruling is a final order, and it can be appealed into the Oregon Court of Appeals. Therefore, if BOLI has issued a declaratory ruling and the local government believes BOLI has incorrectly interpreted the law, the public agency can have a court determine whether BOLI is correct or not. BOLI currently has a policy of only issuing predetermination letters, not final orders, or not declaratory rulings. The Court of Appeals has held that the BOLI predetermination letters are not appealable final orders. In other words, if a local government petitions BOLI for a decision whether a particular project is prevailing wage or not, BOLI can issue a predetermination letter. That letter is not binding on BOLI, and the local government can't get any judicial review of whether that determination is correct or not. Therefore, if a public agency disagrees with BOLI's interpretation, it can't get judicial review, and the local government is faced with a Hobson's choice. It can either acquiesce in BOLI's interpretation, or it can go forward with its disagreement with BOLI's interpretation and await an enforcement action. And even if the court determines that the public agency was correct in its interpretation of the law, the public agency will have to pay possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal costs that it incurred in defending against an unjustified interpretation of the law. We just submit that this is a fundamentally unfair situation. Under current law, then, the public agency, even if it wins, still loses, even if it were to successfully demonstrate that BOLI's interpretation was wrong. Therefore, the city would submit that that those provisions, ORS 279C850 sub 4, 279C870 sub 1, and 652330 sub 1B, should be amended to provide for an award of attorney's fees to the prevailing party in such actions. And I would also point out that that really is sort of the norm for attorney's fees provisions. They are rarely as one-sided as you find in this particular provision. Usually it is to the prevailing party in the action, not to an identified public agency only when they win. There's one other thing I would like to note, and that is that the proposed bill extends the requirement to pay liquidated damages to the public agency where it hasn't provided notice. I would submit that liquidated damages are a concept that's based in contract law and represents an amount of money that parties agree represents the amount that should be paid as a result of a breach of contract. And that really, properly viewed, the way BOLI has applied the liquidated damages provisions, these are really punitive damages. And what we would submit is that this bill changed liquidated damages to punitive damages, that the award be at the discretion of the court, and therefore the court can determine whether, if there is a truly bad actor, what exactly the consequences of such action should be as part of the judgment itself.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
If I might, I know this is a lot to take in today, and we will be sending you information that clarifies basically what the amendments would do and say.
And this is just a public hearing today.
Yes, right.
I'm going to follow up on your comments, and I'm sure my colleagues will as well.
Right.
We'll go from there.
Be happy to answer any questions that you've got in the future.
Great. Thank you. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, a comment, if I would. This comes to you by way of my city, who has had sort of an interesting experience with the prevailing wage issue and these interpretations, and it's interesting that this would be the first thing that sort of pops on our radar on this day. I think there's some fundamental fairness issues involved here around there are disputes in law, and they are costly to all parties. And I think that the attorney has pretty clearly stated that the usual thing is the loser pays. And we have a pretty unfair situation here when one side can go into litigation without, what's it to me? But the other side has huge litigation costs in order to get their issues forwarded to the system that we really have, which is to decide these issues in a court. And so decisions are made not on the merits, but on litigation costs. And that's not right. If you have an issue, and I know it's between agencies in a way, the state and the city or whatever, but there's some fundamental fairness here. So I'm arguing for my cities on their behalf also.
And we are going to have this and other issues like it a lot. So we will take everything under advisement. And I'm sure if any questions come up, you'll hear from every one of us. And unless you have anything else, I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, good. Jessica Adamson from Association General Contractors, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify on in support of this important bill that fixes a variety of issues that came out of Senate Bill 477 last session. AGC believes the base bill, as you see in front of you today, is important because it extends to public agencies the same set of liabilities, consequences that we have today if we make an error. And it fixes something that we all had negotiated, which is if you have these two books, that the contractor can't possibly know all the funding streams for a particular project. So if the agency makes the error, the agency assumes the same level of responsibility and liability that's on the contractor today, and so it balances those rights and responsibilities. We are also bringing an amendment to this bill for consideration by this committee that fixes another unintended issue that arose in the passage of 477. If you look at the copy of the bill that was provided to you by ABC on page 4, about three-quarters of the way down the page, there's one little line that got deleted, and that deletion was projects regulated under the Davis-Bacon Act. We thought we had to delete that little line because that was the way that we could get to this two-rate situation. Well, by deleting that sentence, we also deleted years' worth of case law and interpretation and all kinds of other problems that we didn't realize that we had created until well after it had been signed, put into law. We were all writing administrative rule, and everyone was going along, and one of my very trusty attorneys found the problem. So we are bringing an amendment asking to reinstate that and find a way to get to the two different higher rates another way. It's an issue that we've negotiated with the other parties that were part of the original discussion, and there is, as far as we're aware today, no opposition to this, and we think it's especially critical that we bring that back, especially for folks that do highway work. There are determinations about what the side of work is and what constitutes time on that job site and what doesn't, and what the federal government, how they see it is different than how Boley sees it. And the folks that I work with every day doing highway work are used to the federal determination, and we accidentally threw that out. So it wasn't an intentional act. It was an error, and we're just seeking to fix that and put it back but maintain the whole higher of the two rates issue, which was what was negotiated as part of that agreement. If I may, one last thing. Representative Rosenbaum, you raised a concern about what this does to residential rates. AGC believes that it won't impact agencies dealing with residential rates because Boley has adopted a rule that says when you're doing a project that involves residential rates, the HUD rates are the ones in effect at the time, even if it's a state project. So state funds, federal funds, because Boley doesn't have a residential rate, they're using HUD rates, which are the same as if they have a solely federal-funded project. So they'll never pay, if it's prevailed, they'll never pay anything different than the federal HUD rates unless, for some reason, Oregon decides to do a residential survey. So with that, I'm happy to answer any other questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Whoop, did you have any, sir? Okay. Thanks. All righty, then. Amy Joyce with Oregon Department of Transportation, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Joyce with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today to talk about House Bill 2021. The Department of Transportation executes hundreds of public contracts each year in furtherance of our duty to keep people and freight moving safely and efficiently through the state. The department recognizes the concerns addressed in House Bill 2021, and we do make every effort to comply with prevailing wage laws at all times. But we do want to identify for the committee a possible unintended consequence that could have a negative impact on the department so that you can make an informed decision. The department includes in every specification for public contract notification that the highest of either federal Davis-Bacon or the state Bureau of Labor and Industries BOLI rate needs to be paid. The vast majority of ODOT highway projects are both federal and state funded. So, and the number of trades is unknown when we issue these contracts. The types of trades sometimes even used by the general contractor isn't even known to us when we first send out for contract. So, the specs direct potential bidders to the website where they can check for the prevailing rate, both state and federal, as of the time they're going to make their bid. And in hard copy, the BOLI / Davis-Bacon comparative rate book goes something like 300 to 400 pages. And so we direct these folks to the website. The federal Davis-Bacon Act rates are changing sometimes as often as weekly. After the legislature amended the prevailing wage law in 2005, ODOT was initially sending out with contract specs that 300 to 400 page book with each so that folks could have that in hard copy because that was our understanding of the need under the bill. Based on agreements with BOLI and the industry, we were allowed to just direct folks to the website. It's more efficient for us and frankly more efficient for the people trying to get the correct rate to have that very much updated website information. So we changed our procedure based on that agreement and advice from Department of Justice. So we don't think this becomes a huge concern initially like we thought of generating reams and reams of paper every time we send out for a contract. We intend to keep going with directing folks to the website, and we have spoken with BOLI on this bill, and we're going to determine whether any explicit statutory change might be needed to keep doing that and meet the law. Our primary concern is the penalty provision. Even directing contractors to the website for the wage rate as of that day at BOLI, amazingly enough, occasionally that information on the website can be incorrect, again, because Davis-Bacon is updating sometimes as often as weekly. So we direct contractors to the website, they go to the website, get the information, and in fact it's incorrect. Now we've given them an incorrect wage rate. When that very rarely but occasionally does happen, we make it right. We work with them. We don't expect them to be bound by that wage rate that was incorrect. We work with them. We make up the difference, and we make it right for these folks. Also, when we finish, we get the bid, accept a bid from somebody, and we get down to writing up the contract, we do include in that paper document a copy of the Davis-Bacon rates as of the effective date for those rates. Again, because they update so frequently, occasionally we get the wrong version of the Davis-Bacon rates in with that contract. It gets caught very quickly, and again, doesn't happen very often, but it gets caught quickly, and we make it right. We do a change order with the contractor, get the right rate, get everybody paid. When we make a mistake, we make it right. But in either of those cases where it's, you know, absolutely no fault of the contractor and certainly no willful or negligent conduct on ODOT's part, we've given the wrong rate and now we're on the hook, and frankly that means the taxpayers are on the hook through the highway fund for a liquidated damage. So we want to call that concern to the eyes of the committee. We do believe, however, that in talking with BOLI that we may be able to work this out through administrative rule for those very unintentional situations. But we want you to be aware of that possible unintended consequence. So, ODOT does responsibly advertise and administer our contracts. We're concerned about a penalty being imposed on us and therefore the taxpayers when an honest mistake happens, when we do something wrong, we make it right, and we want you to be aware of that concern.
Any questions? I want them to get it right, too, believe me. I don't think there's anybody in this place that doesn't want the accurate information on that website. I just stress that they get the website right. And this is a very emotional, sensitive issue, and we do need to bring some clarity to it, and I hope we do this session because I don't want to waste any of our taxpayers' dollars bickering over what the wage scale is on any job. So I appreciate your testimony. Is there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So the gist of your comments is basically that when there is a mistake, that the contractor is basically held harmless and the workers get the correct wage at the end of the day.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holby, yes, in terms of ODOT, if the contract wasn't right, we make it right and get the money that they were supposed to get in the first place to them, correct?
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, once again, this is just a public hearing. You guys all got our phone numbers and know where we're at. And I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2021 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2140. Casey, you want to tell us what this is about?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2140 comes to you from the Department of Justice. It makes technical changes to the Public Contracting Code. After the Public Contracting Code took effect in March 2005, there has been a need for bills to be introduced to make technical changes and other law improvement proposals. And so House Bill 2140 is that vehicle for this session.
Okay, I'm just going to go down in order here. Ms. Joyce leaves. She crossed her name off, so... Okay. I'm going to call Dana Anderson, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dana Anderson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. And it's been our responsibility, jointly shared with the Department of Administrative Services and ODOT and others, to make technical amendments to the Public Contracting Code. When it was adopted in 2003, it was a wholesale replacement of existing public contracting laws. And so we knew it wasn't perfect at the time. And we have found that it needs a little maintenance. So in 2005, we sponsored technical amendments and acted as the central repository for those suggestions, and that's what we've done again in this session. I do want to emphasize that if there is opposition to any of those amendments, we'll work with the groups to try to resolve it. And then either delete the item or change it so that the opposition doesn't exist. We do anticipate an amendment that would do several things. I won't outline all the various things that this measure does. We'd be here a long time. I've outlined the key points in my written testimony, and then we will do several things in the amendment that we plan to bring you later, and one would be to clarify the agency procurement authorities. Right now, all of their procurement authorities, particularly on the construction side, were lifted from enabling statutes, and that they all say the same thing, but they say it differently. So we're working with DAS to get those agencies lined up. We're also working with DAS on some technical issues on price agreements and cooperative procurement. And we're currently working with AGC on exemption criteria when competitive bidding is not used for public improvement contracts. So we anticipate all that would be in the amendment we'll bring to you later. So thank you, Mr. Chair. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, thank you. I'll ask you and some nice people out there, Representative Rosenbaum. We spent a lot of time in this on 03, and then Representative Holvey and I believe, spent time on this in 05. And if I remember right, This was the bill that we had to hurry over to the Senate. Is that correct? Yeah, that's what I thought. And we passed it out of the House Business Labor Consumer Affairs Committee without having the exact language. We're not going to do that again this session because I carried that bill on the floor and I didn't have answers to my colleagues. So we're going to get it right before it leaves this committee, if it does leave this committee. And if it ain't right and the language ain't accurate, it ain't leaving. I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to carry it on the floor, and I'm certainly not going to give any of these folks to carry it on the floor. We're going to get it right before it goes to the Senate, and then we're going to pass it out of here, assuming there's support on the committee in any bill. But I just wanted to give everybody a heads up. That's not how we're going to do it this session. So are there any questions? And Mr. Anderson, I'm not blaming you, by the way. It's just we have history.
I brought shoulders, Mr. Chairman. But we're in a different position this time around,
right,
because fortunately the hearing's being scheduled early.
Okay.
And having been through the process before, we understand to work with legislative counsel and get it right.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Are there any questions? All righty then. Oh, did you want something? Okay. All right, then. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. Diane Lancaster, please.
Representative Schaffler, excuse me, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, and I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administrative Services. I'll be very brief today. My testimony pretty much mirrors Mr. Anderson's. We have been working with Department of Justice to help collect now the oddments and bitments of things that need to be corrected and smoothed out. So if you have any questions of me, I'll be glad to answer them, but I don't think at this point I have any more substance to offer.
Okay.
Other than we're very supportive of the work.
Great. Thank you. Any
Thanks,
questions?
Sir.
Anybody? All right, then. Thank you. Jessica Adamson again, please. Jessica. And I know Jessica can sympathize with us that have been through this before, because she's been there right with us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. Public contracting rewrite was a big project for AGC in 2003, and we appreciate those on this committee that have been there and listening to this issue for the number of sessions that they have. And Mr. Chair, I want to let you know that we are encouraging this committee to take a very deliberative look at this bill, and we're not encouraging any kind of hurry on this bill. This bill, unlike last session, does involve some actual policy changes that are different than the ones that we presented last session. And so we want to highlight just a few of those that have AGC concern and want to say before we even do that, that we've talked to the Department of Justice and they have assured us that we'll work on these in amendment. But these are very significant changes in policy, and want to highlight those for you, if I may. The first is dealing with emergency contracts. These are the kind of contracts that some of which happen in the middle of the night. A water main breaks and you need to get somebody out there right now, and it doesn't matter who they are or what process you get. You pick the person who answers the phone in the middle of the night and you get them out there on the project. And then there are emergency contracts where you have a couple of days. You don't know exactly what it is that you're dealing with, but you have some time before you get somebody out there, and it might be a long-term emergency contract. When we rewrote 279 and divided it into the three parts that's in now, A, which applies to everything, B, that is purchasing, and C, that is construction, we specifically left construction emergency contracts in C, because where possible, we wanted emergency contracts. If you had time, and Highway 35, the whole Mount Hood debris removal is the example of a contract where you have some time to have a little bit of competition. You don't want to just hand that out to the first person you call. You want to make sure that you have some competitive bids. Everyone has a fair shot. You get the best price, and you have the best contractor out there doing that work. That's why we left that procurement process in C, because C has those kind of procedures. It's designed for construction. As it turns out, according to the Department of Justice, the way that we defined emergency contract makes them all be 279B side procurement. So they're a service procurement. They're not a construction procurement. In talking with the Department of Justice, we have reached an agreement that we're going to bring in some language from rule that clarifies that and directs agencies that if they can, they should go through a procurement process if they have time, or as much procurement process as is feasible. Construction projects, as the chair knows, can be very expensive. They can be very time-consuming. And if you're talking about an emergency contract, you might be talking about a day. You might be talking about a week. You might be talking about several months of work and, you know, thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars, perhaps even millions, depending on the size of the emergency. If you're going to spend that kind of money, even in an emergency, you want to make sure that you've got a competent contractor and that you've gone through some process. So we want to add some more language into 279B if that's where these procurements are going to happen, because the section that they would happen under is pretty thin on process. It's basically whatever the agency wants to do, and we don't necessarily think that's appropriate in all circumstances. The other issue that we have is found several times throughout the bill, but is found first on page 18 in section 14 of the bill. And this deals with findings for alternative procurements. And again, this is a 279C issue. In construction, the standard process is what we call design, bid, build. And it's where you get an architect or an engineer and they make drawings, and then the agency sends them out to bid, and you get a whole bunch of bids from different contractors, and the low responsive bidder wins. So everyone bids on the same information, everyone bids on the same set of wages, and the only thing you take into account is the low responsive bidder. Do they have their bond in place? Can they get the insurance? But you're looking at everyone on the same playing field. You aren't taking into account other factors. For example, what's their time frame for doing the work, or have they done this work before, their experience? That isn't part of the design bid build process. Statute does allow for something called alternative contracting, and it's known as a RFP, a request for proposal, design build, CMGC, all of those kinds of terms that you'll probably have the opportunity to hear a lot more about in the next few months. But the alternative contracting process allows an agency to take into consideration other factors, experience. The makeup of the company, have they done these kind of projects before? What's their time frame? Can they work with an architect and an engineer and come up with something a little bit different than what the agency would have come up with? There are different procurements done for more complex projects. If you're building a school in which you might have kids, you're doing a rehab where you're going to have kids there and you're going to be building at the same time, you might want to do an alternative process because you're going to want to take a look at what are they going to do for safety factors. How are they going to stage the project so it doesn't get in the way of the kids? There are reasons for doing alternative contracting, but Oregon statute places a pretty high burden on the agency if you're going to do it. If you're going to do an alternative process, you have to make findings, and those findings have to be that it will result in a cost savings to the contracting agency and that it will not substantially diminish competition. And these were provisions that were negotiated among public agencies, AGC, and other parties over a decade ago when alternative contracting was just coming into vogue, because we wanted to make sure that contracting agencies didn't run out and start issuing RFPs for every other project, because they may or may not result in cost savings. This bill seeks to change the standard relating to cost savings, and the bill itself says that it would like to have the finding be that the awarding of the public improvement contracts under the exemption of the alternative contracting procedure is reasonably expected to result in substantial cost savings. We view this as taking something that is hard and fast and making it a lot more subject to interpretation. We understand that what the Department of Justice is trying to do here is address the situation where if you say it will, what you're asking an agency to do is say on Sunday it will be dry, sunny, warm, and 60 degrees. You can't control factors in construction that are going to drive a cost up when you estimate in advance that you should save money and then maybe you don't. We appreciate that. We get that. We're contractors. We understand that changes happen. But this standard, if left the way it is, will, we believe, leave open to a lot of litigation, confusion, and a focus on a process as opposed to what are you actually doing. And so we're working with them to create some language that we believe will drive the agencies to actually create a process and make findings that are real and actually do research and estimating and those kinds of things that we believe are necessary to make sure that before an agency enters into an alternative contract, because they're expensive to administer, they're usually reserved for complex projects, that first of all they understand what they're getting themselves into. They're not as easy to administer as a design bid build. But the second, that they do actually believe it will save the agency money over time. We share some of those same concerns in their new proposal for pilot project alternative contracts. We're happy to work with them on that. I apologize for the length of my testimony. I know it's a Friday afternoon, but in order to make sense of some of this, I felt like I needed to give some background. So I appreciate your patience with me. Thank you.
Well, Jessica, we're going to be spending several Friday afternoons with one another, so we may as well get used to it. Are there any questions? Okay, and I just thank you, Jessica. I just want to clarify one thing I said. In no way, shape, or form, when I said we're not going to do that this session, am I in any way implying that the chair of this committee was any less of a chair than I am? He's a friend of mine, Chair Brown, Alan Brown, and I just didn't want to imply that. We were under the gun. We all voted it out. I take my responsibility, but he treated us with the greatest respect, and I just want to get that on the record, too. So, anyway, are there any other comments today? Well, excuse me, let me close the hearing. Anybody else want to speak for this? I want to close the hearing on House Bill 2141. And we do have some business left.
We do, yes, Mr. Chair.
You want to explain what we're doing here?
Well,
just go right off the script.
Right, sure.
All right, then, let me make sure. Okay. Yes, I'm opening a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. Teresa, you want to read this off?
Yes, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, you have three LC drafts in front of you, LC 2174, 2175, and 2176. All three LCs are at the request of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. LC 2174 is relating to bonds required by the OLCC for operation of a winery. What this would do is that it provides that the bond will cover taxes on the sale and use of agriculture equipment and also creates circumstances in which the winery would be exempt to waive the bond under certain circumstances, primarily when they are not liable for a privilege tax. LC 2175 adds persons who hold a grower sales privilege license to the list of who a licensed Oregon warehouse licensee can serve. And finally, 2176 modifies current statute regarding reciprocity in direct shipping from wineries to consumers.
All righty. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2174, LC 2175, and LC 2176 be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Esquivel moves that we introduce LC Draft 2174, LC Draft 2175, and LC Draft 2176 as committee bills. Those of the opinion, LC Draft 2174, LC Draft 2175, and LC Draft 2176 should be introduced as a committee bill will say aye, and those opposed will say no. Do we need to do a roll call here?
It's up to you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any opposition? And I want to remind all of those, especially those new, this no way, shape, or form commits you to any vote in this committee or on the floor on any of this language. So all we're doing is introduce committee bills. So, all right. Do we need to do a roll call? Is there any objection?
No.
All right. The motion carries that LC drafts 2174, 2175, and 2176 will be introduced as committee bills. Thank you. With that, any more comments for the good of the order? All right. Well, then, I will call us adjourned.